recently there's been a fair amount of discussion of happiness. The French news magazine I subscribe to, they had a whole 1/3 of the issue devoted to happiness. And then more recently, the New Yorker magazine had an article on happiness. And today I'm a little ill, so excuse me if I'm a little foggy up here. But that's also a good time to talk about happiness when you're ill. You have every reason not to be happy. There are also a lot of Buddhist books, as you may have noticed, with the word happiness or something like that in the title. So somehow Buddhism has gotten interested in happiness, like The Art of Happiness or How to Be Happy. And there's one chap, I can't remember his name, a Tibetan teacher who's, I guess, I don't know, allowed himself to be billed as the happiest man on earth. What? Anyway, that was probably some publisher's idea of a catchy ad campaign. So, you know, when Buddha talked about happiness, it was tended to be in fairly general terms, and one of the useful things that Buddha did was to point out the obvious sometimes. So he said, beings want to be happy and don't want to be unhappy. Which is like, well, duh, that's right. And then, of course, he proceeded to talk a great deal about unhappiness. That having been one of the primary, maybe the motivating force behind his own search for some understanding. Of course, in Buddha's story, we see that, at least on the surface, all of the ingredients for happiness were present. And all he needed to do was reach out his hand and take whatever he wanted. But that didn't work. So, and in fact, he discovered that the existence of the sentient being is, its bottom line, if you like, is dukkha. Now, dukkha is not, I would suggest, is not unhappiness, but it is, as I know we've talked about before, this level of unease with our own existence. And basically, it can't be our own. Now, the opposite, or you might say, the antonym of dukkha in Sanskrit anyway, is sukha, which is sometimes translated as happiness, but I kind of don't think in the Buddhist context that that's all that useful. Sukha is more like ease, where dukkha is more like unease. And the sentient being is kind of perpetually uneasy because his or her or its manifestation in the world is based on an illusion. And a tremendous amount of energy is needed to shore up that illusion in the face of what we might call reality. So the sentient being is constantly like one of those stage performers spinning plates. Sentient being is constantly spinning plates and then dashing back and forth. ideal, of course, trying to prevent them from breaking, but some always get broken, so minimize the damage. And this, if this is happening on, you might say, the existential level, then we are going to be very uneasy. And sometimes that will be at the forefront, sometimes not, but Buddha said it's always, that thread is always there until one is awakened. And then that thread is broken forever. So does that mean then that one is happy? Well, possibly, but happiness as I see it, you know, is just another of our many states of mind and body. So if someone asks me, are you happy? Well, then I just look and see if in that moment I would say, yeah, I'm happy. Or if I'd say something else. So the I assume, although I haven't read them, that the Buddhist books on happiness are not about how to locate, establish, and make permanent a frame of mind called happy. I don't think that's what those are about. So, also, though I'm not sitting up here preaching against happiness like it's some bad thing, it's just that there's something lacking in the concept of happiness as the touchstone for a successful or satisfying life. The article in the New Yorker was looking at, among other things, all kinds of stuff, marital status and it looked at one of those, or more than one of those, studies where the investigators went to find some people who like won the lottery or something, and then some other people who did not win the lottery and were kind of poor, and tried to measure their relative happiness, which of course is a little tricky. Measuring happiness is also a little funny, a little difficult to do. You can't just ask someone, so are you happy? And then write down their answer. And not if you're being psychologically rigorous. Anyway, they did manage to find that the people who won the lottery were overall not that much happier than people who hadn't. And in some cases, they were worse off. Something about their situation, when all this money was pumped into it, actually got more uneasy. And sukha, or ease, withdrew even further. And then they also looked at studies of people in other cultures where the, you might say the standard of living is quite low, but the people's basically, their spirits seem to be pretty good most of the time. So all of these puzzles have presented themselves to humankind to look at for as long as there have been humans. And although I don't want to get the reputation of being a killjoy, I think we should, you know, it's good to be clear about where Buddhism is comes in on this whole discussion. One of the first things I noticed in the New Yorker article, which was pretty good, basically, I like all their stuff. Except their fiction. I don't actually care for their fiction very much. But anyway, the article uses a number of different words interchangeably. So it starts out with happiness, and then somewhere along the line you got contentment or, you know, satisfaction, and they're all kind of mixed in together, which I think is probably not so accurate. In the also, interestingly, in the list of the so-called dharmas, the constituents of existence according to one or another school of Buddhism, sukha is not one of them. So what we call happiness, according to this theory, the Abhidharma theory, is made up of actually smaller, more discrete elements that are not themselves happiness. So we take our seat as people of the way in the midst of this peculiar life situation, and with its thread of unease. And we demonstrate, by our practice, we demonstrate a kind of ease that wraps around that whole dichotomy of sukha and dukkha. By taking its stand in the perfection of wisdom, which of course teaches that sukha and dukkha both are dependently co-arisen. Neither has ultimate existence. So our practice of Buddha's way is aligned with that truth and expresses that truth in all the complex and orchestrated activities of body, speech, and mind that we engage in. And so there's also an old story, which I know many of you have heard before, of our ancestor Dongshan. And you know, he goes to his teacher and says, I still have some bad habits. And the teacher says, well, what have you been practicing? Dongshan, in his usual snappy way, says, I don't even practice the Four Noble Truths. Yinyan, his teacher, says, oh, indeed. So are you joyful? Which I think the Chinese says, if I remember, are you joyful yet? And Dongshan's famous reply is, it's not that I'm not joyful. I feel as though I have found a jewel in a dung heap. And so, notice that Yunyan does not ask him, are you happy? He doesn't ask him that. He asks him, are you, and the Sanskrit word anyway, is mudita, which is the first of the 10 bodhisattva stages called the joyful. I think it's quite interesting that he doesn't ask Dongshan if he's happy. He asks him if he is, has he been swallowed up and is hidden in the life of the Bodhisattva? Has he entered that path? Is he expressing that vow in all of his activities? If he is, that's known as the joyful. And of course, Dongshan says, well, you know, it's kind of funny. Very nice jewel, very not nice dung heap. And this, I think, is an excellent expression of our experience and practice as people of the way. We're all familiar with the dung heap. And by and by, as we practice, we also come to know the jewel. And of course, those two are not separate. Dung heap and jewel are no more separate than sukha and dukkha. And in the unfolding of that realization, that discovery, that practice, there is something like peace. So it wasn't clear to me that the author of the article had that in mind, but I think it'd be good to be clear that we are, at least in this practice, we're really talking about peace, and not necessarily a frame of mind that, well, like our cat, Buckley, you know. I notice that after he has his breakfast or dinner, he's often purring. He just sort of sits there and purrs, you know. And presumably, this means he's a happy cat. But of course, that's completely dependent upon circumstances. And when he gets hungry again, the purring will stop. So So this is the typical way that we as sentient beings proceed, and we would like to find the next event or person or thing that will enable us to purr. And if we don't find that, then we maybe will not be so happy. And if that goes on for a long time, we may feel very bad about our life and ourselves. And sometimes when that happens, people will encounter the same sort of deep inquiry into the nature of this body-mind, this human existence, as inspired Shakyamuni in his own search. And then we can go looking for what happiness is, where peace is. What does it mean to be joyous? Should I strive to be happy? Should I strive to make others happy? Should I go around asking people, are you happy? Perfect strangers, excuse me, are you happy today? Sometimes, you know, the solution to the riddle of existence, if you like, is sometimes is presented as though it would come from without somewhere. For instance, some people say that in order to be happy, all you need to do is express a certain kind of relationship with, for instance, Jesus, or, you know, Allah, or something. And that expression, which winds up in many cases sounding like a kind of pledge of allegiance, will confer happiness. But I must say, I don't see that anywhere in my gleanings of Christianity. I don't see that as really an adequate explanation, nor in Islam, nor in any other faith. Simply making certain gestures and certain professions of belief or allegiance will not help. And it tends to be quite dangerous because often when people come to the point of making such a gesture or a declaration, you know, they're kind of running out of rope. And then if making that declaration doesn't work either, then sometimes things will look very, very, very bleak. And once again, peace will recede even further. So if you'd like to be happy, you know, I would suggest that all of us, myself included, first of all, figure out what we mean by that, and then try to determine, based on our experience of ourselves and the world, whether that's actually attainable. And if it's not, then what should we be after? What is true peace? If it be not anything that our friends, the advertisers, seem to have been able to package and distribute, though they try often, very often. So maybe instead, you know, we should hear Master Yunyan's question in our own hearts. When he asks, are you joyous? Are you joyful yet? and have our whole practice life, our whole expression of Buddha's way, be a response to that question, our answer. And see if we can spot the signs of peace, growing peace in our own life. Even though I'm not sure you can see the peace itself, you can see its function or its effects. And quite possibly, one of the keys that allows that peace, joyfulness to emerge is in the expressing of the Bodhisattva vow, which, as you know, is pretty transpersonal. It aims pretty high, even though it says, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. The I, which isn't actually in the Chinese, there's no I in there. Seigan, you know, in the kanji. Accept or receive, I forget exactly now, the vow to save all beings and all delusions and so forth. So the I is not really front and center. And therefore, our expression of this vow puts us in alignment with something that is beyond our, not just our day-to-day preoccupations, but even our metaphysical preoccupations. This inaugurates and supports the movement of our whole life energy away from dukkha, away from unease, to a much broader and brighter territory. Whether, in making that journey, one will determine that yes, one is happy or not, is not so important. There's something much more alive than that. So I'm certainly not telling people not to be happy. Not by any means am I saying that. But don't be fooled. Don't be fooled by the arising and passing away of any frame of mind, whether you like it or you don't. Don't put your eggs in that basket. So having said all that, I'm wondering, let's see, am I happy? Well, I'm not unhappy. My head still aches a bit, but I don't mind so much. Of course, I could be completely wrong about all this, and one of you in this very room could be in line to be the next happiest person on earth. Someone will write a book about you, and you can, go on talk shows and tell people how you did it. How did you do that? How did you become the happiest person on earth? Well, what do you think? I always invite people to protest. Yes, Reverend Wren, back there.
I think it's interesting that happiness could be something that, you know, the implication that you could have more of it. You know, so it's something
you
could be the happiest person on earth. That's like something you could have.
More than somebody else. Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. And I also was going to say, I think that happiness, even the Buddhist may all beings be happy, sort of, I think it's kind of problematic as a concept because so often it's contingent, you know, upon circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really hard to unhook it from circumstances.
Yep.
And so, you know, I've always found that just, you know, conceptually a problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, that idea of happiness.
Yes.
And what you said about we have to figure out what we mean by that, it's, you know, I think that's really important.
I think in the Metta Sutta, I think they may use the Sanskrit participle sukhita, which means having been eased, or being at ease, something like that.
At ease or at peace.
At
or
peace,
like
right,
that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Somehow at rest at home.
Right, at rest.
Yeah.
Something more like that would be, I think, in the Buddhist, you know, kind of.
I think that's right. Yeah.
In the Buddhist field would be more accurate and more what was intended rather than happy, which can be linked to your burning your toast in the morning or something like that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But by the way, cats also purr when they're anxious. It's how they comfort themselves.
Oh, I see.
So
I see. Yeah.
Just to put that out there.
Yeah, I see.
It's just about the next smack.
Well, of course, you know, Buddhists don't say there's anything wrong with happiness.
Right.
We want to be clear about that. Just that it can be a slippery slope, especially if you try and make it arrive and stay.
And the other thing is, you know, there's another one of those concepts that comes up often in Christianity and not so much in Buddhism, is hope.
Hope,
you know?
Yes.
And I mean, it's very big in Christianity and in Buddhism, it's almost anathema to, you know, to kind of being a good practitioner because it implies that you're not in the present moment somehow. But, you know, I don't think it's, I think that that's very widely interpreted also.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
So,
anyway.
The absence of hope actually has a lot to do with inner peace and happiness.
The absence of hope. Not being like tripped up by hope or trapped by it.
Being content with where you are now and embracing who you are now.
Mm-hmm.
And then being able to be tranquil from within and being able to bring that and to heal the rest of existence with that tranquility.
Mm-hmm. It's a tall order.
Yeah.
But you start small, you know, or not even, you start where you are. Start where you are and who you are, and God, there's so much there. You know, it's so rich, and you don't have to keep inventorying it to figure out whether you got something to offer. Just be as you are, who you are, as we constantly are saying in this little American corner of Zen.
Mm.
You
know? Go with the current,
huh?
Go with the flow. Go with the current.
Yeah, yeah. And the flow is definitely there. I don't know if you noticed this morning, but it's definitely present. We got some flow going on here. I'm happy to say. Yes.
It seems like there's also a tremendous effort if you're trying to only have one kind of response or one set of experiences or one lens that you know, like only this has value, so that
the pink lens.
Yeah, that all the rest that's there that is a different shade. Either won't be seen, or you know, we're constantly turning from it and not having space for.
I remember
all the
our
different colors.
Yeah, I remember our founder Isan once. One of the many times he was having struggles with James, his on again, off again boyfriend. Anybody know James from that era? Did you know James at all, Rinsan? No. Anyway, he was a handful, I must admit. But and one of those times I asked Isan how he was doing, and he said, well, it's a pretty rough patch. But he said, but it's so rich. It's so rich. It's like that sank in when he said that. Finally, I thought, I'm going to figure out what that's about. And well, I didn't figure it out, but it blossoms in practice. Whatever that means, it blossoms in practice.
It also feels as though going without words and being one with your intuition and speaking from here,
mm-hmm.
speaking from your intuition,
mm-hmm.
and allowing that to coordinate your thoughts,
mm-hmm.
is really what brings you in harmony with existence,
mm-hmm.
and helps you to harmonize with what's happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings, that helps you embrace the happiness
mm-hmm.
from within,
mm-hmm.
because it's already there,
mm-hmm.
just like the current and going with the flow is already there,
mm-hmm.
it's there, it just needs to be seen. It doesn't, it's not like a rabbit running around the garden, you don't need to go and grab it, it's already there.
Grab that rabbit, yeah.
Yeah.
Although that's what we're told often. Just
yeah.
grab the rabbit and you're, you know.
Yeah, it's more like the blood. It runs through your veins. It's
right.
there already.
Mm-hmm.
You just need to be able to embrace that
mm-hmm.
you have blood.
And this is the underpinning of our sitting. You know, the deep, profound trust that so enables us just to be still, take our place and be still. Yes, Joe?
I notice in my work, when I work, if I do groups or something, and I just noticed it more and more recently, for some reason, that some people are just naturally content.
Mm-hmm.
And other people struggle a lot more with that, so they're more in the struggle to find some contentment.
Yeah, right.
But some people, it's like, they just have that. They don't ever seem to have a place where there's a major struggle.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they're kind of accepting, it's not even like anything they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just who they are.
Mm-hmm.
They present with a kind of even keel,
mm-hmm.
and they seem quite content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah, this is that book, you've seen Once Born, Twice Born Zen? Have you seen that book? I think it's Lucian Strike, who's the author. It's very interesting. He made this point that there is like these kinds of two streams, particularly in Zen. The Once Born is kind of like you're talking about, these people who, for whom the practice of contentment is like an ongoing reality. And then there are others who, something has to happen first. So they need, they're the twice-born kind. They have to get born again before it will happen. And the other style or stream is more like it's cultivated now. Now, for a lot of my practice, I was in the twice-born camp. And that was kind of burdensome. And in fact, the richness of this our Soto Zen tradition didn't really begin to reveal itself until I dropped that and started wondering about what is the immediate practice of great peace, not how do I leapfrog over there, which looks really good, as opposed to here, which I don't like. So I think this is even just within Zen, let alone within Buddhism, there's this interesting division of styles. Did you want to say some more?
Well, I think similar to what you just said there a second ago, I've just found myself learning a lot from these folks,
mm-hmm.
even though I'm kind of the second style myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm learning a lot. It's like, it's nearly choosing to struggle,
mm-hmm.
or choosing to kind of not. Like
mm-hmm.
choosing to struggle or just choosing to accept
Choosing this, choosing this. Now.
Mm-hmm. And it's I find it kind of inspirational.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are no problems, there are only solutions. And usually, at least from talking about the two streams, it seems like my spirit was reincarnated in the other stream.
Mm.
A lot of stuff happened to me growing up in my upbringing, and I was in a lot of different circumstances that were very much not, it was me, yet it wasn't me.
Mm.
Obviously it was me because it was occurring and happening to me. It wasn't me though.
Mm.
It did not look like my reflection when I saw it and experienced it. It was more going through my brain is how could this be me?
Mm.
Or how is this me?
Mm.
And within my spirit was that there was always a solution, and that my spirit just needed to embrace the solution and be optimistic about what was happening.
Mm.
Which at first it came in the form of just me being optimistic much of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the awareness of it grew.
Mm-hmm.
And noticing the difference between not being optimistic and being pessimistic.
Yeah.
And learning what true optimism is.
Yeah.
And then
I think this gets at something that Randy, you were talking about, this notion of where does hope come in Christianity. I think a more mature understanding of that than maybe compared to what we were introduced to as kids is... It's sort of like hope is so important because its opposite is so deadly, despair. And to despair basically means you're turning your back on your identity as a child of God. And that is the worst mistake ever. So as I understand hope in Christianity, you might want to comment there. It's more like hope. It's almost like trusting one's profound Buddha nature. To change the vocabulary, you get a deep hope in the inalienable truth of one's being a child of God. So, but it's true. When growing up, you know, hope sounded mostly like the pie in the sky type of thing, which was. I don't know, just because I was a kid, I don't know why I had to be told that, you know.
Yeah.
Their children can understand more stuff than just, like, be a good little Catholic boy so you can go to heaven. You know?
Yeah.
That's not very interesting. Would you like to comment at all, Reverend?
This is a little off the topic, but I couldn't help it. When you kept speaking, I don't know why Thomas Merton kept coming to mind, and I think he's one of those, like, first he was the two type.
Yes, good point.
And then he moved to be the one kind of person.
I think
that's
right.
I remember when there's in his journals there's this line that he says when he got to Bangkok, he said, I looked in the face of the stone Buddha and I
mm-hmm.
saw everything I'd been looking for my whole life. So
mm-hmm.
that resonates like how we imagine
yeah.
hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing about the jewel in the dung heap,
mm-hmm.
One of my favorite things he ever said was, he said that, you know, in this world, we are not called to struggle for holiness, but rather find holiness in the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Thomas Merton?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. Sounds kind of zen.
It does.
Yeah,
mm. Yeah, it sounds truthful.
Mm. Yes, well,
I think one can see hope and fear as kind of the flip sides, the two sides of the coin of attachment.
Mm-hmm.
But what we were, and words are so imprecise. Hope in the sense, of, in the more positive sense that we were using it, kind of seems to me like the shraddha, the faith of Buddhism that keeps you moving forward steadily.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Buddhism, shraddha or faith is more like. I mean, the emphasis is that Buddhas experience and understanding is not only true but available to all beings because of our nature. Because our nature is Buddha at its root. So, and I think there are echoes and parallels in Christianity that are quite powerful.
Yeah, if each the origins of the spiritual teachings from each of those, what they call religions now, was to attain the inner peace,
mm-hmm.
they all in some ways got obscured
mm-hmm.
by different hands that had been passed through.
Mm-hmm.
It feels as though those who originated the ideas and the teachings of each of those different spiritual teachings would have agreed with each other.
Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to think that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my own life, I think I learned, it was a certain learning curve. And when I was young, if I felt unhappy, I would go out and find some pleasure fix of some sort. And that would do the trick for a while. But
mm-hmm.
like Britney Spears found out, you know, you can't live that way. I got a little bit more experience and I learned I could handle my feelings. You know, I could do a little mood alteration just
mm-hmm.
by, you know, smiling and, you know.
That stuff makes a difference.
Right. And and just by telling a joke and,
mm-hmm.
you know, those little things came along. And then I got a real boost when I started practice. I
mm-hmm.
found days I feel happier for some reason. I didn't really understand why
mm-hmm.
either.
Well, today we're sitting together till lunchtime, and so we're not going to give you any cookies right now. But if you either stay until noon or come back, which would be kind of cheating, you can have cookies. But right now we're just going to sit a little bit more. And I have periodically sat with the migraine before, and for some reason it seems to make it worse. Just don't know why that is, but I think it must be tied to the fact that I started having migraines at my first practice period at Tassajara. So I think it's some weird karmic thing, which is very interesting. So, am I happy? I'll do. This'll do very well. Thank you all very much for coming.